Good afternoon again, everyone. As I mentioned, we're on a little bit of a tight schedule, and so we're going to try to get started a little bit early and then end a few minutes early to accommodate the airplanes and to accommodate Senator Collins' schedule. At this point, let me ask Joe Falk to come up and introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Tom. It is my pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, to finally welcome my good friend, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, to Naples in the Forum Club. I say finally because Senator Collins first committed to speak to us here about 2 years ago, but had to cancel because the majority leader, Harry Reid, always thoughtful, scheduled a last-minute and very unusual Friday vote in the Senate, which required Senator Collins to be there and thus not here. The reason is that she is one of the very few long-serving members of Congress that has never missed a roll call vote. Over 5,000 now and counting. I have known Susan for many years, as my wife and I consider her our summer senator. Let me explain. We spend half the year here in Naples and half the year in Seal Harbor, Maine. So we have always been interested in and concerned about Maine politics. Frankly, as Susan is well aware, if Maine did not have an 8.5% income tax, well, as we all know, Florida's is zero, we might very well have chosen to reside there legally instead of here. I think I share that thought with many here. But anyway, that is a state issue, and Susan, as a United States Senator, is concerned with more important national matters. So let me get on to her qualifications, which are impressive and significant. She is a real Down East native, born and raised in Caribou, Maine, which is about as far north in New England as you can go. She's a graduate of St. Lawrence University in upstate New York, so she is a true Larry. She worked in Washington for several years for Senator Bill Cohen, and when he retired in 1996 to become defense secretary, Susan successfully ran for the empty Senate seat. As she said to some of us last night, she went from being on the condo board to being one of 100 senators. She has now served almost 3 terms in the Senate and will undoubtedly run for her 4th term next year. Now, one of the most senior Republican members of the Senate, Susan was until recently chairman and then ranking member of the Homeland Security Committee, where she enjoyed a great bipartisan working relationship with her partner, Joe Lieberman. Term limited out of that position, she now serves on the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee and the Select Committee on Intelligence. In the political world, Susan is known as a moderate, and she has a well-deserved reputation for reaching across the aisle and seeking bipartisan solutions to problems. This is not just a matter of political expediency in a purplish state like Maine. It is what she believes in, and the people of Maine love her for it. She currently enjoys a 75% approval rating in Maine. In truth, as Susan knows, I don't always agree with every vote she casts, but I can tell you that on the key issues, especially those involving national security or our nation's fiscal health, she is a solid Republican. She is going to speak to us today about the economy and the budget, or lack thereof. However, with her extensive background in Homeland Security, please also feel free to ask a question at the end of the area in that area, at the end of the speech in that area as well. So now please join me in welcoming my good friend, Senator Susan Collins.
That was very nice. Thank you. Thank you so much, Joe, for that kind introduction. I was a little worried about the beginning, where you were going to go with that story. But I am thrilled that I am finally able to be here with such a prestigious group. I also want to thank Joe and Leslie for their kind hospitality, for putting me up last night. I came in extra early to make sure that I actually got here once we saw the weather forecast. And it's been a delight to see so many old friends from the state of Maine, Ambassador and Eula Norris, for example, and to see Larry Pugh and so many others that I know from our state. But I have to say that I'm particularly impressed that you managed to have a member who is from Washburn, Maine, which is right next to Caribou, where I grew up, and several St. Lawrence grads in the audience as well. So clearly this is a highly representative group. There's no doubt about it. Well, Maine, as you know, is a stunningly beautiful state, but I will concede that spring is not our best season. And perhaps that's, we should stop calling it the mud season, even though that is descriptive. But I'm not surprised that many in this room flee to Maine for our wonderful summer, fall, and I would say our winter months are pretty great, too. Now, speaking of things that bog us down occasionally, I want to talk with you today about the federal budget and our nation's long-term debt. And I'll also talk about what I think is the one thing that can get us moving again, and that is a bipartisan approach to solving these very real problems. I could not help but think, as we listen to these outstanding students today, that it is our generation that is leaving them a crushing burden of debt if we do not act. And I was so impressed with the students who were here today and their dreams for their future. And I want them to be able to achieve those dreams. And I really salute the club for inviting high school students to come and hear these speakers. It seems to me that there are several potential senators in the group that we heard today. And I would just ask that if any of you are planning to run from the state of Maine, that you wait till I retire. Now, I'm told that last November you heard a presentation from Gallup's CEO, who told you that he commissioned a group of economists that predicted that within 30 years, global GDP will triple, raising to $200 trillion, but that America's share would only be about 15%. Right now, our GDP is about $15 trillion, and although the estimates vary, that's about 22% of the world total. Clearly, a drop to 15% is a bleak prospect. Since World War II, our annual growth rate has averaged over 3%, yet these economists predicted a future rate of only 2% for our country, compared to 5% for the rest of the world. America can prevent this decline as a global economic power by getting our fiscal house in order. Our national debt, the sum of years of deficit spending, is now a staggering $16.7 trillion. And the tab for every man, woman, and child in this country is approximately $53,000. And that, my friends, is our legacy to future generations. Debt is, of course, the result of borrowing. And on January 20th, 2009, the day that President Obama took office, the country had a gross debt of $10.6 trillion. Since that time, we've added about $4 billion per day to that already staggering sum. And with debt, of course, comes interest. The United States paid $223 billion in interest last year. Think about that. That's more each month than we spend on the Coast Guard's entire budget for a year. That's more each day in excess of $610 million than the annual value of Maine's fishing industry. That's a lot of clams. Very good, just testing. And lobster, mussels, and haddock. It's estimated that in just a few years, our interest payments to China, our largest foreign creditor at $1.2 trillion, will be covering the entire cost of that country's military. So at the same time that our country is bound by treaties to defend our allies in Asia against any potential Chinese aggression, American taxpayers are bankrolling the threat. Excessive government borrowing crowds out the private sector, stifles business investment, and slows economic growth. Respected economists calculate that when public debt, that is borrowing from individuals, institutions, and other governments, reaches 90% of our gross domestic product, economic growth will be 1 to 2% lower than it otherwise would be. Our public debt hit nearly 73% of GDP at the end of last year, up from 40% of GDP in just 4 years' time. And this truly understates our problem. Our total debt, which includes the amount that we owe to the Social Security Trust Fund, for example, now exceeds the size of our entire economy. Now, if you look at the chart that I've provided, it's entitled Major Components of the Budget. The first thing that you'll notice is that the columns tallying federal outlays from 1980 through 2020 increase at an alarming rate. And in just a few moments, I'll talk about the dominant orange section, which represents entitlement programs. But first, I'd like to draw your attention to the red section, which grows from a relatively insignificant portion of each column to, by the year 2020, the third largest spending component. Those are interest payments. And we have been very fortunate as far as the cost of interest, that interest rates have been so low, that they've been artificially low, historically low. Their increasing size will ultimately become a major roadblock to economic growth. A University of Chicago economist, Robert Lucas, has written that is what is most striking about the current so-called recovery is how slow almost invisible this recovery has been relative to the four other recessions our country has suffered since 1970. Why is it so slow now? He suggests that the explanation is found in the policies coming out of Washington, and that they have weakened our recovery and put us on a treadline resembling the stagnation of the European welfare states. We cannot accept this low growth trend line, or the stagnation of today will be but a preview of a diminished tomorrow. It's crucial that we adopt policies now that will put our economy back on the higher growth track that it is the historic norm. And these policy changes on several fronts have one word in common, and that is reform. And since this year marks, much to Joe's dismay, the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 16th Amendment that established the federal income tax, let's start with tax reform. Someone once said that what America needs is a tax code that looks like it was designed on purpose. The IRS's National Taxpayer Advocate has called upon Congress to simplify the tax code by examining every provision and applying this basic test. Does the public policy benefit of the provision outweigh the complexity burden it imposes? And that burden is heavy. The tax code is nearly 4 million words long. Individuals and businesses spend about $6 billion a year doing taxes, the equivalent of 3 million full-time workers. The cost of tax preparation exceeds $168 billion annually. Now, I could entertain you at length with egregious examples of tax code provisions that range from the obsolete to the absurd, but then I would not have time to talk to you about anything else. I favor a comprehensive overhaul of our tax system to make it simpler, fairer, and more pro-growth. And indeed, there's widespread and bipartisan agreement that the tax code is too complex and in need of a complete overhaul. That's the easy part. Consensus breaks down quickly, however, when it comes to specifics. First, what is the fundamental purpose of reform? Is it to produce more revenue, more growth, or a combination of the two? Second, tax deductions, credits, and the like represent foregone revenues to the federal government, what in Washington speak we refer to as tax expenditures. These tax expenditures add complexity to the tax code, but they also can promote behavior that we seek to encourage. So how we address tax expenditures is a major and difficult issue upon which to achieve consensus. And let me just give you a couple of examples. At a projected cost of $379 billion over the next 5 years, the mortgage tax interest deduction is the third largest tax expenditure. It is also an extremely popular tax break. It allows people like me to buy homes. Now, Canada does not have a mortgage interest deduction and largely avoided the housing collapse that we saw in the United States. So is there a link? Does the tax break help middle-income Americans afford homes, or does it inflate the cost of homes, or does it do both? What about limiting the deduction so that it only applies to the primary residence rather than to two homes? Well, if we did that, what would be the impact on Maine and Florida, which happened to rank Florida number one, Maine number two in the nation in the number of second homes? Let me give you another example. Charitable contributions. That's projected to be the ninth largest tax expenditure at a cost of $238 billion. Will charitable contributions decline sharply among those who itemize large donors if deductibility is either eliminated or capped as the president has proposed? Well, taxpayers with incomes above $200,000 account for about a third of all charitable donations. And the Philanthropy Roundtable estimates that charitable giving would decline by $5.6 billion per year if that deduction were capped as President Obama has proposed. So that raises other policy questions. Is reducing or capping or eliminating the charitable deduction compatible with reducing the size and scope of government? If we're trying to shrink the federal government, aren't we going to be looking at nonprofit organizations to fill in some of the gaps and to help ensure that we don't have holes in the safety net? So these questions are but a sample of the issues that need to be addressed in bringing about comprehensive changes to our tax code. It's why everyone in Washington embraces tax reform in the abstract, but consensus quickly evaporates when we start discussing the specifics. On the other side of the federal equation is, of course, spending. In 2012, nearly 64% of the $3.5 trillion in total federal outlays went to mandatory obligations for some very worthwhile and essential programs: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, civilian and military retirement obligations, as well as interest payments on the national debt. That's 64% of the budget. Now, consider that we can spend that $3.5 trillion only because we borrow $1 trillion on top of the $2.5 trillion that we get in revenue. In fact, spending on mandatory programs eats up 83 cents of every dollar we collect in federal revenue. And if you add the interest costs, you quickly get up to 92 cents of every revenue dollar. So that's all spoken for before we even consider what is called discretionary spending in Washington. And just because it's called discretionary doesn't mean that it isn't vital. Discretionary spending includes national defense, education, transportation, biomedical research, a lot of spending that many people would consider very important. Now, the president has to lead as we start to tackle these issues and set priorities and make difficult decisions. Already his budget is months late, which is not a good sign. But I'm going to start today by talking a bit about the mandatory spending, or entitlements, as they're often called. Clearly, we need to strengthen and preserve Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. But if we do not reform these programs in a thoughtful way that allows us to keep our promises to those in need and to our seniors, the programs are going to run out of money. They are not sustainable. And a quick look at that chart I handed out tells you the tale. The orange section are entitlements, and it grows so large over the next decade that you can almost feel its crushing weight on our nation's future. Medicare illustrates the challenges we face. I serve as the ranking member on the Special Committee on Aging, where I serve with the chairman, who is Senator Bill Nelson of Florida. And by the way, that's especially fitting because Senator Bill Nelson represents the state with the largest percentage of seniors, but I represent the state with the oldest median age. That's actually not a good thing because it means the younger people are leaving the state of Maine. But the very first committee hearing that we held was on how Medicare could be strengthened for today and for the future. Now, Medicare provides essential health coverage for more than 50 million of our nation's seniors and disabled citizens. Prior to Medicare, more than half of all Americans over age 65 were uninsured, and nearly a third lived in poverty. Today, virtually all seniors have access to health care coverage through Medicare, and poverty rates among seniors are less than 9%. So Medicare has been essential to both the health and economic security to our nation's seniors for almost 50 years. But it's time for our country to have a serious debate about how we secure the future of Medicare. The alarm has been sounded in the most recent Medicare trustees report, which projects that the Part A trust fund, which covers hospital stays, skilled nursing care, post-acute home health care, and hospice benefits, will be exhausted in just 11 years. We don't have a lot of time. This year, Medicare is projected to cost about $600 billion. That's 15% of total federal spending. Increases in healthcare spending coupled with the demographics associated with an aging baby boom population pose serious challenges to Medicare in the 21st century. The number of people receiving Medicare is going to soar, and there are going to be fewer and fewer workers paying into the Medicare Trust Fund. That combination is the healthcare equivalent of the perfect storm for the federal budget. So we must look for ways to slow Medicare spending growth while continuing to provide quality care for an aging population. The key to getting Medicare costs under control is to get healthcare costs under control, and that is no easy task. Today, we spend 18% of our gross domestic product on healthcare. That's more than any industrialized nation, and yet we lag behind many nations on measures of quality. In healthcare, quantity does not always equate to quality, and it's clear we've got to do more to reward value rather than just volume. One of the aging committee hearing witnesses that I found most interesting was a physician who's involved in the Dartmouth College Atlas Project. And it uses Medicare data to look at regional variations in care. And just to give you an example of the disparities, they looked at Medicare patients discharged from the hospital after surgery and then readmitted for a problem related to that surgery. Well, the rates varied from more than 18% in the Bronx to just 7.6% in a town in Oregon. The anomalies that the Dartmouth study identified will not be corrected by slashing benefits, but rather by reforming our healthcare delivery system. And an area where we can save money and improve care is the treatment of chronic diseases. And I am the founder and the co-chair of the bipartisan Senate Diabetes Caucus, and I want to use this disease as an example. One third of all Americans over age 65 have been diagnosed with diabetes, and one half are at risk of developing the disease. There's been a 41% increase in the cost of treating people with diabetes in the last 4 years. Medical expenditures for people with diabetes are more than double compared to those with people without the disease. Now, here's the astonishing statistic. Today, one out of every three Medicare dollars is used to treat and care for people who have diabetes. One out of three. Over the next decade, the amount is expected to be $2 trillion, and $1.7 trillion of that amount will be paid for by the federal government. So this is becoming a health problem of epidemic proportions. And if we keep on this trend line, it's going to overwhelm our healthcare system, bankrupt Medicare and Medicaid, and could actually lower the average life expectancy for Americans for the first time in more than a century. Now, here's the problem with our system. Medicare currently covers costly procedures, and I'm not saying it shouldn't, to treat the complications associated with diabetes. For example, amputations. The problem is that it does very little to actually prevent those complications from occurring in the first place. A physician who has his PA or nurse practitioner check each week on someone who has diabetes does not get reimbursed for those phone calls, for that close monitoring. And yet, if that person develops all sorts of problems, the reimbursement is made. So the solution is not to cut benefits, but to change what we reimburse for. And I want to give you an example of a bipartisan bill that I've introduced, which is estimated that it would save the Medicare program billions of dollars by allowing millions of Medicare beneficiaries to take part in a proven diabetes prevention program. And it's a structured 16-week session that focuses on healthy eating, physical activity, and it's been demonstrated to reduce the onset of type 2 diabetes in those most at risk by nearly 60%. And the YMCAs across the country are involved in this program. Now, it's estimated that implementing community-based diabetes intervention programs nationally could save $190 billion over the next 10 years. Why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we reimbursing for those kinds of programs? It's surely significant that three large private insurers are already covering this program and others. And what they have found is that they save $4 for every dollar that they invest in these prevention programs. So by covering that benefit through Medicare, we could make the same kind of wise investment in seniors' health, reduce a lot of suffering, and save a great deal of money. Let me give you another example. Jennifer, where is Jennifer, the student? There she is, who wants to be the personal injury lawyer. I hate to tell you this, Jennifer, but if we did medical liability reforms, we would reduce the costs of defensive medicine and save some $40 billion over 10 years. So I hope you become an attorney, and I know you're going to be a fabulous one, but choose a different field, okay? That's my advice to you today. Now, I'm going to shorten my remarks because I want to make sure you have time for some questions, and I know I'm going on a bit long, but let me just say a word about discretionary spending. That's the smaller part of the budget, but as Everett Dirksen said, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon it's real money. And there is so much we could do. For example, in the area of farm support programs, do you know that there were more than 76,000 wealthy farmers who received federal farm program payments? That doesn't make sense to me. My potato farmers don't get anything in northern Maine, but if you grow soybean, rice, wheat, you get a guaranteed price and a subsidy. The farm bill that we passed last year in the Senate would have saved $23 billion over the next decade, but did not become law. Improved management and common sense application could also save billions. Last year, federal agencies paid $108 billion to the wrong person for the wrong amount or for the wrong reason. In a recent three-year period, federal checks totaling more than $180 million were sent to about 20,000 people who were deceased. The government also spends $1.7 billion every year to maintain taxpayer-owned buildings that are either vacant or grossly underutilized. And perhaps the greatest irony of all is that there are 56 different programs housed in 20 federal agencies, all redundantly trying to improve the financial literacy of the American people. I think it should be the other way around. The American people could teach government a thing or two about financial literacy, starting with pay for something once, not dozens of times. There are so many examples. Tackling these problems by delivering common sense, competent government worthy of the American people requires all of us in Washington to work together. But too often, in today's hyper-partisan atmosphere, those of us who do reach across the aisle to work with colleagues of a different party end up being vilified by both the far left and the far right. In fact, my staff considers it a good day when the blogs are attacking me from both the far left and the far right. I try to think of it as just some guy in his underwear in his parents' basement who doesn't have a job, you know. But the fact is that the problems we face are too serious for us to allow partisan politics to prevent us from getting to solutions. All of us, there's a role for partisan politics, but once the elections are over, as one constituent said to me, why can't you all just be Americans first? And I do have some hope of a breakthrough in bipartisanship. A few weeks ago, President Obama called me and attended our Senate Republican Conference lunch. I think these overtures are very belated, but they are welcomed nevertheless. But what we really need from the president is what one columnist described as a candor offensive, not a charm offensive. Leadership is sorely needed. There are some other hopeful signs. We finally, for the first time in 4 years, actually passed a budget after an all-night session. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that it was a completely partisan budget. I opposed it because it never balances over the 10 years. It actually adds to the debt. It increases taxes by over $1 trillion. And it contains no real tax or entitlement reforms. Other than that, it's really good, you know. But in times of crisis, I take comfort in remembering the words spoken by Winston Churchill in the dark early days of World War II. He said, "Americans will always do the right thing after they've exhausted all the alternatives." We've exhausted all the alternatives: excessive borrowing, budgetary gimmicks, printing money, the blame game. Now we are left with that quality of our national character that has seen us through crises throughout our history: our resolve and our willingness to pull together. But it is going to require the American people to recognize how difficult the choices will be, to understand the need for sacrifice, and to support lawmakers who are willing to put the next generation ahead of the next election. I thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you today. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Collins, thank you for being an American first, and thank you for being a leader. We're proud that you're a U.S. Senator. Even though we can't vote for you here in Florida, we're still proud.
Thank you.
Please take with you a couple of books of sunny Southwest Florida that you can at least enjoy on the plane on the way home. I'll put them at your seat. And Joe, maybe you've got a couple of questions.
Okay, we just have a few minutes here. As usual, the Forum Club has come up with some great questions, and they are not all related to the budget. They're all over the place. In fact, I'm going to start with one that isn't really on point. How dangerous is China's cyber espionage to American security and commerce? Can we stop it? And I would add, because I was going to ask this too, are we going to stop it by just telling them to stop it and sanctioning them? Are we going to develop real defenses that'll work?
Well, first of all, thank you for that question, because believe it or not, the alternative subject I wanted to speak on today was cybersecurity. I have done a great deal of work with my former colleague, Joe Lieberman, in this area. And there is no doubt that the continuing, daily, ongoing cyber intrusions from China in particular, but also the Russians and increasingly the Iranians are a threat to our economic prosperity and to our national security. We are having our business R&D stolen every day. There was a company in Wisconsin that lost $1 billion of research and development and trade secrets overnight due to an intrusion probably from China. In the Intelligence Committee, and I can say this because the report is public, there is a new study by the Mandiant Corporation that has just come out that has actually pinpointed the building where most of the attacks from China are coming from. China has a national policy of stealing our economic secrets. And I don't think we're doing nearly enough in this area. From the perspective of Homeland Security and national security, I cannot think of another area where we are more vulnerable and the threat is greater and we've done less to counter it. I introduced with Joe Lieberman a comprehensive cybersecurity bill that would have allowed more information sharing between the public sector and the private sector so that we can share evidence of intrusions and learn from them, and so that information could be shared with other businesses and government agencies so that they can develop protections. And unfortunately, it did not get through, although we twice brought it to the Senate floor. This is extremely serious, and we do need more aggressive measures. We are going to have to not only develop better defenses, but we may need a stronger offense as well. But it is a great, great concern. And it isn't just on the corporate side, although that is so important to giving us our economic edge. But we have seen evidence of weapons systems designs being stolen, of probing of our critical infrastructure. By that I mean, for example, the electric grid, transportation, the air traffic control system, natural gas pipelines, all of them, we've seen evidence of intrusions. So this is going to require a cooperative effort with the private sector and government working together, and it is extremely serious.
Okay, now we're going to switch to a political question. What are the chances of the Republican Party retaining control of the House and regaining control of the Senate?
I'm very optimistic, the president's efforts not to the contrary, notwithstanding, that Republicans will keep control of the House of Representatives. Republicans should have taken control of the Senate this past fall. We were poised to do so, and frankly, we had some candidates who were not good choices, and I feel that we kicked away some seats that we should have won, and it was extremely frustrating. And as someone who campaigned very hard for Scott Brown in Massachusetts, for Linda McMahon in Connecticut, and Linda Lingle in Hawaii, that was harder duty than it sounds. I did out one day, back the next. I was so disappointed to see those terrific candidates brought down by comments, very unwise comments made by some of our lesser quality candidates. I'm sad to see the loss of Dick Lugar, for example, an extraordinary senator and a wonderful human being, who would have won in a walk if he had won his primary. So I hope we can learn from that. If Republicans don't take control in 2014, next year when I'm up, then it's going to be a long time. So I hope we don't blow our chances again. And not only do we need good candidates, we need a positive vision for America. We can't just be against. We have to set out what we are for and what we want to lead our country.
Okay, here's yet again another different one. What would the effect be of using and developing our oil and gas resources? How would that affect the debt and the deficit? That's easy.
Joseph, that's an easy one. Well, there's certainly more that we can do to develop our domestic sources of energy. And the energy picture has really changed dramatically with the discovery of the natural gas fields and new techniques for getting the gas out. I come from a state that has the highest percentage of homes that heat with heating oil in the country, and that's a real burden to the people of my state because it's very costly and we have very long cold winters, so they're wonderful winters, I hasten to say. And so I'm very eager to see natural gas coming into Maine, but we need the pipelines. We don't have the infrastructure. I'm for the XL pipeline to come down from Canada to bring natural gas from the Canadian sands, tar sands. And I think, I hope the president will make the right decision on that. You know, the irony on that is Canada is going to extract that natural gas regardless. The only question is it going to be shipped to China or is it going to come to the United States? I'd like it to come to the United States.
Okay, this is going to have to be our last question, and I'm going to give you one right in your wheelhouse here. It's from one of our students. You may have set this up earlier. How do you think that we can bring about more moderation in Washington? Why, in your opinion, have the politics in D.C. become so much more partisan?
Great question. Which student wrote that question? Over there. Excellent. Zach, right? Zach and I did talk a little bit before, but I didn't plant this question. Zach, I think there are many causes of the increased polarization in Washington. One is the 24/7 news cycle that we did not used to have, and the fact that people are increasingly tailoring where they get their news from to sources that they already agree with. And it used to be when I was growing up, you watched Walter Cronkite and all of America got a similar kind of news. Now you can find either a radio show or a television network that basically reinforces what you already think and doesn't challenge you to think about the other side. In addition, because of this 24/7 news cycle, there almost anyone can get on television now, and those who have more extreme views are considered to be more interesting guests than a boring moderate like me. You know, if you go into a rant from either the far left or the far right, you can get on the news pretty easily. If you think that the issues are more complicated and more nuanced, then there's less interest in your views. Even though I think most Americans understand the complexity of issues. So 24/7 news cycle is one. Gerrymandering of districts is another. That has been a real problem because what both parties have done is create safe districts. And that means that whoever wins the primary wins the general election. Maine's unusual because we have very competitive districts and competitive races. But in lots of the country, it's either a safe Republican seat or a safe Democratic seat. And what that frequently produces is someone who is from more the more extreme part of both parties. So I think gerrymandering and a lack of competition is another issue. A third is we're seeing the political map become more regional. And I think this is a bad development as well. I am one of only two Republican federal office holders left in all of New England. There are only two of us, Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire and myself. That's not healthy for our country. And the South is increasingly becoming just Republicans. And I think it is much better to have a diversity of views within a caucus so that regional differences are better understood and different viewpoints. So what do we do about it? What we should do about it is I think the American people have to start rewarding people who are trying to make things work and through their votes and by getting involved in their campaigns. They've got to focus on people who want results, not just rhetoric. And finally, I will say that I think part of the problem also reflects society at large. There is a decline in civility in society at large, and that gets reflected in Washington. Think of the use of the internet to smear people. Think of and hide behind the anonymity of the internet. Think of bullying in schools, which has been a problem. You know, the internet is both wonderful and yet a curse in some ways because it does allow people to say hateful things that they would never, ever say if they were face-to-face with you or had to put their name to it. And I think that part of what we need to do is to raise the level of public discourse and civility in this country as well as in Washington. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Collins, thank you very much. Joe Fogg, thank you for bringing Senator to speak to us. Thanks so much.